Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hello. Today, we are going to talk with John Monroe on the podcast. John was the CEO of a company called Chargeback, which was a SaaS business in Utah that I had an opportunity to be on the board and work with John on and be an investor with Next Coast Ventures. And it was an incredible ride. And John is a tremendous leader. And I'm really excited to learn and share what the learnings that John has this morning with the group and to have the conversation. Welcome, John.
Julian, thanks for having me. Stoked to be here this morning.
Yeah, I'm excited. We've been talking about, you know, having a debrief conversation on the Chargeback ride for quite some time now. It was a really exciting ride with ups and downs, and I'm sure you've got a lot of lessons from it. You did an incredible job, and that was a big win for the team at Chargeback and a big win for Utah. And I'm excited about exploring it with you.
Thanks so much for the kind words. It doesn't always feel like all of that, but I know in the end, sometimes it looks like that, and you can accept that a little bit more, right?
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's start by just framing the journey. So you joined Chargeback in 2018, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about what Chargeback does.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think currency and trust in currency is absolutely fascinating. And so, you know, you think about the past 100 years, credit cards came into significant use. And one of the things that I think a lot of people miss in that process is that, you know, the ability to dispute a transaction or to dispute something that's been charged on your credit card is one of the most essential pieces to that puzzle. And so credit card companies have gotten that right and have done a great job at protecting the consumers.
Because it provides you safety.
Absolutely.
To transact with someone you don't know over the internet, across the world.
Absolutely.
But you have that feeling that if something goes wrong, you can do what's called the chargeback, which is one of the, I think, key assets of the company that you ran was the name of Chargeback. But that's a credit card dispute, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the power right there, right? Your ability as a consumer just to feel that confidence that you can just submit this very easy dispute. They're going to give you your money back. You're protected. They're going to deal with that. Well, of course, most people don't understand that that makes an absolute disaster on the retailer side, right? The retailer is guilty till proven innocent and just creates a kind of, you know, really big challenge.
What does that mean? Guilty to proven innocent?
The money from the consumer is, assumed to be accurate, assumed to be the one who deserves the money back right out of the gate. So the retailer, whether they delivered the good or service or not, whether it's a fraudulent chargeback, whether somebody stole the package from the person's front step that has nothing to do with the retailer, they're guilty until proven innocent in that scenario. And so it is a disaster. Overall,
what do they have to do? So someone charged back, the money's out of my account. Now, what do I have to do as a retailer?
Yeah. So I have to create this document called worry presentment. And what that is effectively I go back and I provide a lot of evidence, evidence across the spectrum, right? From customer service calls to order management systems, to CRMs, to transaction histories, to just a bunch of different evidence. It's really difficult to collect and correlate. And so at Chargeback, we built a SaaS platform that actually solved this issue. It integrated a bunch of those data sources, made the process really automated, and I think even created a streamlined process so much so that we were actually able to create a better communication channel up front for the consumers. A huge percentage of chargebacks actually occur because the consumer doesn't recognize a transaction.
Right.
We actually were able to create some solutions that prevented a bunch of chargebacks from happening from the start. So really, really cool process and great solution.
Okay. So your customer is someone who's selling typically online, but maybe doesn't have to be. And this is the departments, the finance group or the operations group that's dealing with these chargebacks. And you basically have created a TurboTax type of tool that allows them to process and respond in a rapid manner. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an easy button, and so much so that if they do it right and they have the right integrations, that the easy button is, it actually prevents it in the first place. So they
Which
don't
is,
even
of
have
course
to.
Better for everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Better customer experience. Better certainly for cost savings for the retailers, for less product that they don't get mm-hmm. compensated for.
Okay, so you joined the company in 2018, and you were there from 2018 to 2021. Like, describe the journey in terms of just size of company. You know, where was the company from an ARR or revenue standpoint when you joined, and where was it when you guys exited?
Yeah, a fascinating place. So to set the stage, the company was going through a conversion from really an analog company or a services company to a SaaS. SaaS first model. They had made great strides in kind of getting to that point, but the software hadn't kept up. So in 2018, when I joined, there was incredible demand for the solution and certainly a software solution that would solve these problems. Our ability to actually supply those was pretty challenged. So we were less than $1 million in ARR, and that actually included some really cool, great promises from some world-renowned retailers who put a lot of trust in the organization and the vision that had been sold to them. And we had about 28 employees, I believe, at that time when I came in and jumped on board.
Okay. And then, just to set the end stage, you guys exited in 2021. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, late 2021, we're able to exit to an incredible partner called Sift. So Chargeback is still a very thriving and critical piece of kind of the digital ecosystem for fraud and dispute management, as well as to, I love one of Sift's key phrases is to help everyone trust the internet, right? Mm-hmm. To create an environment where consumers can trust it, retailers can trust it, and you have just a really positive ecosystem. And so we were able to exit to Sift, who was a partner previously, and we were creating some really cool solutions together before they decided to bring us internal. And at that time, I believe we were 8 million ARR and had about 75 employees. So it was a pretty quick swing
sure.
Lots of growth during that time.
Yeah, no, that's a great growth journey. Obviously a great outcome for the team. And I have to share, this is a company that I think I shared with you. I had seen 8 or 10 years earlier through the Park City Angels. And I knew it was an interesting idea all the way back then because I was in the travel space and we were one of those retailers that really struggled with managing chargebacks in the travel space. It's one of the largest categories. And so I was well aware of this problem and I was well aware of this company. And I remember when I got involved, which is, I think was like maybe a year or so before you, mm-hmm. I was like, man, these guys are still around. And one of the things that I learned was they had gone through 5 or 6 different CEOs before we found you. So not only did you help grow the revenue and engineer an exit, but you managed to succeed where a lot of people hadn't. What do you have to say about that? What do you think the secret was there?
Well, I think hopefully we can dig in a little bit further in the podcast and some of the lessons learned from that. But excuse me, I think from the perspective of feeling like people that had come before me were phenomenal CEOs, talented individuals, amazing folks. Why could they not solve it and I would be able to? I can say that was a consistent theme that ran through my mind. At least on a weekly, monthly, sometimes hourly and hourly basis as I was operating the organization. But it really drove me to create an environment where, the option of failure was, well, I guess I'll just be put in this pile of 5 or 6 other folks that couldn't quite make it happen. And failure is
a little intimidating, I would think, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I want to be clear, failure is a relative term. I think failure is not necessarily as negative as people say it. It's just not the outcome that we achieved, right?
Yeah. So. Well, it wasn't an easy challenge to go from a service business to a software business is not easy. I mean, I think that what I recall is that you had validated the problem, you had validated the customer need through the services. And quite often SaaS becomes, it's often services in a spreadsheet that forms the inspiration for SaaS, but making that transition is quite challenging.
So, absolutely.
I'll turn it over to you. What are some of the things you're most proud of? What would you like to talk about that, you know, you felt was critical to making that journey of transforming into a SaaS business and getting that traction and growth and ultimately the exit? What are some of the best learnings from that experience?
Absolutely. Maybe I'll reflect a little bit on the organization. You know, as an organization, our really biggest accomplishments, one of the things I'm most proud of the team was they really embraced the trust in new leadership coming into the organization. You know, it had been an organization where there had been, obviously, as you mentioned, 5 or 6 CEOs. There were employees that had been through nearly every one of those CEOs there from the beginning. So we had folks on the team that we retained that were with us. The gross majority of them were with us till the end, that had gone through those processes. So their ability to actually step in and say, "Oh, new CEO, great! I'll trust this guy." Like I
did. Were they a little skeptical? Did you have to overcome that? Oh, here we go again.
To say the least. And so I had to overcome that. But even more miraculous, they did. Right. Yeah. They were able to actually step in and truly give their hearts and souls to this effort and truly trust that we were moving in the right direction. So, you know, rather than trusting that they would be put last, that they had in some prior instances, we put them first, right? And so we really stepped in, and so their ability to step in and really jump onto the ride, we would not have been able to have the outcome that we did if that weren't for that case. So that's one of the things.
How did you bring them on board? I have to imagine there'd be a lot of skepticism with that kind of track record, and you know, people starting to worry about the future. How did you turn that around and build the culture that you're describing now?
Man, that's a great question. So one of the things that I think always kind of stood out to me about the organization was a lot of the employees, especially historic ones, even founders, right? The founders who had been there since the SaaS conversion, you know, they had a scenario where they really could have had every reason not to trust folks. So mm-hmm. We had to come in initially with protection, right? Literally, one of our core values was respect. Often mm-hmm. You have to have a core value that should be just a baseline for every single organization, be something as strong as respect. We had to actually have that in there as a result of making sure that everybody recognized that they would be protected, they would be respected, their opinions, the way that they showed up every day, whether that was good, bad, or ugly for a while, was respected. And so I think that was one of the biggest things that we did is I really led with vulnerability. And I will say significantly that I overshared most of the time that I was leading the organization. I have actually overshared whether that would be our financials, whether that would be our fundraise challenges when we were successful or fell flat on our face with some of our fundraises. You know, seeing that vulnerability and creating that environment where people expected that transparency, I think is really kind of that magic bullet. There is never a magic bullet, of course, but it's as close as you're going to get to a magic bullet to trust, to creating an environment where people feel like, well, it's all out on the table. I feel like he couldn't possibly share more. And the team couldn't possibly be more transparent. And I think that really set the stage for them recognizing, look, this is not great. This is where we are. This is where we're going to. We hope that you'll be part of the journey. We have faith that we're going to make it through the journey. And we were obviously successful in doing that. But it was not a pretty picture. And so that team's ability to kind of look at that picture and recognize maybe outside of my naturally positive demeanor that we were going to be able to get there, I think was a pretty pretty big reason for that success.
And what did that look like? What was your cadence of communication? And what did you do differently from how the organization was communicating in the past?
Great question. Yeah. So I think tactically, we really dug into how do we make sure that I mentioned the trust dynamic, right? One of the easiest things tactically to do when we're trying to build trust is be consistent. Mm-hmm. So we just had to be extremely consistent with the cadence of when we communicated. So as simply as we had monthly all hands meetings, the mm-hmm. entire organization.
Now, was that something that was happening before, or was that new for the organization?
There were parts of that, and they had some pieces of that, but it didn't look like certainly wasn't consistent. It was canceled all the time. There were lots of things that I think were allowed to get in the way. Some very valid reasons, as you're a startup and you're scratching for the surface, right? So it's not a judgment on what was happening before, but for this stage in the organization, they needed stability. They needed expectations to be aligned with kind of the outcomes that they were seeing. And so once a month we had those. We had, of course, weekly stand-ups per team. Some of the teams had daily stand-ups. And we really just were really consistent with ensuring that our message was consistent, the things that we said that we would communicate about, we did, whether good or bad, and that we really kind of continued in that process. And I think that the all hands, the way that we structured those, might have been a leg forward or a you know, an easy button for us internally to create more of that trust than we might have been able to create otherwise.
Okay, so you come in, there's some skepticism. You lead with some vulnerability. You're establishing two-way respect through that. I think you're also being very open, sharing some of the good, bad, and ugly. Mm-hmm. What were some of the key cogs that caught and you start gaining traction? What were some of the things where you started feeling, okay, now we're starting to move in the right direction?
I love that question. So I think some of the things that really drove that growth, we found some traction in a couple of key industries. So we had the CEO prior to me was an incredible visionary and created a vision with customers, created a vision even internally with a lot of the folks in the organization that was really what the solution should look like and where it really needed to be. Well, of course, as we know, as we execute and from an engineering standpoint, it's often much harder to build what you want to build than what you can build, right? And so there was a lot of protection that had to occur from taking the promises that had been given to some of these incredible national brands that everybody knows, you know, largest shoe company in the world, Dick's Sporting Goods, some of the largest aviation providers, travel, et cetera. And we actually had to step through that process of saying, hey, client XYZ, we know that you were promised this. This is what we can deliver today. And this is what we're promising to be able to deliver to you a year from now. And they'd kind of raise their hands and say, wait, what about all this other stuff, right? And so we had to go through a lot of really, really difficult conversations and say a lot of no's in order to put the organization in a place where they could feel enough stability to actually execute and deliver some incredible solutions out to the market, right? So we were kind of 80% of the way on a bunch of solutions and things that we had built for the customers, but very little that was really to that 90%, 95%, wherever a startup naturally should be. Certainly it's not 100% perfect. But
it never is, I think.
Yeah, but much closer to a solution that is a little bit more stable and comprehensive and has the ability to actually deliver on the promises that are made. And so that actually was a major milestone for us, being able to be in that scenario where the employees felt protected, like they were not going to continue to be mentally, physically, and emotionally exhausted in the process. They still worked hard and we really, really drove forward, but kind of protected that first, and that ended up leading to.
Would you describe that as kind of reducing scope and focusing on some key areas to get key wins?
Absolutely, yeah. I think I call it now the no's, right? Knowing when to say no.
Yeah.
And you know, I think for any organization, especially a growing one, I remember listening to a podcast right in the middle of this battle where we were trying to figure out our way. We were trying to figure out what to do, what we could focus on, what we couldn't. And they were talking about product-led growth, and they said simplicity is really the kind of key to winning. And I wish I remembered the podcast or I could listen to it again, but the timing was perfect for me at that time. You know, we as an organization, especially as a leadership team, were really struggling with what do we do? Where do we go? Look at all these incredible opportunities. You know, we'd see these massive, for example, aviation was a great example, massive opportunities in aviation with some of the biggest names. And, you know, all we had to do was build a couple of things. Well, we had an amazing engineering team who was able to scope what build a couple of things actually means. And it became very clear to us that, you know, that was the future. That was where we needed to go. That was where the organization should be able to deliver in a perfect world, but we weren't going to be able to get there fast enough. And certainly what we were going to do is not serve the rest of our balance of our customers as we got there. So we had to say no.
If you reached for that new solution for the aviation customer.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then we get caught between two and you don't absolutely serve anybody, right?
And really in our case, it was caught between six or seven. Okay. And so we whiteboarded it out, six or seven core solutions and industries that we were focused on and supporting. And I think in that endeavor or that dynamic, we found ourselves, I think recognizing at the end of a couple key meetings that I still vividly remember that, and we have to say no. And then it was, the scare.
Yeah, that's so scary, right? Because you did everything. You probably taken months, quarters, years to get that meeting. And now they finally are there asking for the order. Man, how do you get the courage to say no at that point, right? Because that's got to be so psychologically difficult.
Yeah, almost impossible, especially as you're struggling with imposter syndrome as a CEO, being in a chair that five or six CEOs had been in before. Really difficult, really challenging. Mm-hmm. But it ended up being, I, in retrospect, absolutely the right answer. There's just no question in my mind that we would have taken on some of those challenges.
Because you wouldn't have succeeded, right? Correct. And you would have stretched yourself too thinly. Obviously, we're dealing with limited funding, limited resources, yeah, limited opportunities. Were you able to serve those large customers with your limited offering? Did they stay with you?
Some of them, absolutely, yeah. Some of them we were able to serve. Others of them, we put more on a shelf and said, hey, we're excited to have this conversation in 2 years, but today is not the right day, right?
Right.
And fascinatingly enough, we kept good relationships and some of them kept kind of knocking on the door and saying, okay, are you ready?
When are you ready?
Okay, yeah, are you ready? Okay, you're ready. Which really was validation.
They saw the vision. You have to, and that's at the startup stage, you do have to talk about the vision, obviously, but you can't spread your resources too thin across the front line where they can't get anything done, right? And so having a vision is important, but if they were happy with the basic product or the product you decided that your team could build, that I assume that was able to serve the majority of your customer needs?
It was, and we certainly, don't get the wrong impression, we innovated on that platform significantly over that 2.5 year period. So we added a bunch of new solutions. We incorporated some big things as well as doing a full rewrite of what was a pretty monolithic solution. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of the process that required the no's and the pauses is we actually had a couple of months where we said, we can't take on any new customers, which as a growing startup, you're like, wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
How do you deal with that? No way. And so I can tell you those
were to that board meeting.
Oh yeah. I know that you were part of it. So yeah, not fun.
Yeah, that's impressive. So, all right, that's a hard lesson to learn. But it sounds like you're happy that you had the courage to take that one and really focus on what you could achieve with confidence. Give your team the ability to win. Give your customers something that you had confidence to deliver, and that kind of I assume would build on itself where you'd get some wins and you start getting, I'm a football coach, as you know, so it's getting that first down. Absolutely. Right. And I remember you and I talking about, let's get a couple of first downs. Mm-hmm. Let's get in the red zone. Let's get some field goals. Let's get some touchdowns, but you can't go straight to the Super Bowl is kind of the analogy I think you and I were using at the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Good. Well, what are the lessons? If you look back now, I know that when you're in the fire, you're super taxed from all directions and you're making the best decisions you can, but often it's a year or two later when you look back, you say, oh, you know what, if I had a chance to visit my earlier self, here's another lesson I might have shared with myself. Any ideas like that?
Yeah, I think there's two core things that really come up to me, that I find myself kind of coming up against continually now as I think back on that process and certainly other organizations that I led historically. And that is this, it kind of relates around the imposter syndrome as well as trust your instincts, right? On many of the personality and assessments, one of the things that pops up is that one of my core personality traits is a pleaser, right? So mm-hmm. That works very well when you're thinking about customers, very well when you're thinking about, are you right, willing to put in that extra time, energy, and effort to be successful? And I will argue that grit and what that drives as a result of that pleasing mentality has been definitely a significant contributor to some of my past successes and my past organization successes.
And you were in customer success and customer service, you know, through your career.
Absolutely.
Right? So you applied that skill to the natural areas, and that was part of your leadership journey, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so thinking a little bit deeper as you apply that to leadership, that's a really, really slippery slope, right? Especially as you're leading, you know, 100, 200 employees, not everybody's going to be happy all the time. And in fact, sometimes the exact thing that they need does not make them happy, right? It's like you think about your children or your football players and how you're trying to coach them, right? They want this immediate outcome. They want what makes them feel good right then. But you recognize that truly to actually provide them with what they need in order to move forward, it's the painful stuff. It's something that might even be as much as
weightlifting.
Yeah. Weightlifting, absolutely. But it might be something as much as you got to get out of here. This is not the space for you, right? This team is not where you belong. You're going to add a lot of value somewhere else, but it's not here, right? And so there's a lot of challenges that come along those lines. And so I think if you apply that to the leadership journey and really look to trusting your instincts, trust your instincts early, especially about employees, don't feel the sunk cost fallacy as strongly as it can kind of overtake or overcome you, and allow yourself to be in a position in a situation where you give yourself the opportunity to reassess and allow that to be okay. Yes, this was my decision. Here's where we were. We're no longer there. Things have changed, even if they haven't materially, even if you just made it a bad decision. Really, really, you know, finding those mentors and superiors, board members, subordinates, et cetera, that give you feedback in order to keep you sharp.
Well, it can help you give courage to those convictions, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Because that's, I think that what I hear you saying is you kind of hear it inside, but you're a little, you know, they're hard decisions emotionally. And so to trust your instincts, it's great to have some mentors, some coaches, some board members who you can bounce these ideas off of, right? Because it's not something you're going to talk to their peers about.
Absolutely. And remembering that the CEO role is the loneliest seat in the world, right? You can't necessarily talk to your board about everything, despite having phenomenal board members like Julian and some of the other incredible board members that I was lucky to have. You can't necessarily talk to your spouse. Certainly can't talk to all your executives, because some of them are outside of that. So really finding those people that you can connect with and whether it's a YPO or some other you know, professional organization like that, you got to find it and you got to dig in and be vulnerable.
Absolutely. Now that makes a ton of sense. So let's quickly talk about the exit. You mentioned that this Sift was someone you had partnered with before. I see that a lot. You know, were there any things that you did that you look back and say, hey, that was really fortunate that we accelerated this partnership, or you created some relationships, or your team members created some relationships? Any lessons in terms of, you know, what worked well for you guys in this case that you bring forward to your future opportunities?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, one of the startup scenarios that's just so common to have conversation around is do we license this thing? Do we keep it internal? Do we protect all the assets so we can use it however we want to in the future? And there's so many lessons learned, even just in the Utah ecosystem of, you know, people who licensed too early or brought on key partners too early and gave them too much of the organization and vice versa, right? So I think that's a, you know, a big piece of the process and a big part of what you kind of have to navigate through. For us, we knew that a couple of key partnerships were going to be the way that we were likely to find an outcome for the organization. It was clear to us as we talked to customers that we needed to be part, and even explicitly clear, where a customer, I remember vividly one of the customers I was going to visit in my first couple of months, huge customer, very loyal, were really helpful in growing us. They said, hey, you need to be a tab in this other system. I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Right.
I said, you got to be a tab in these other guys, or they can be a tab in you. One of the two, one of you has to buy each other.
But they don't want to buy multiple point solutions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so recognizing that right out of the gate and that we couldn't actually build ourselves into being robust enough to handle all the solutions, we knew it was going to be a partnership. We knew it was going to be strategic acquire that kind of took us out. And so it ended up being, so one of the ones that we had looked at and that we were most excited about just kind of never got excited about us for probably almost a year that we courted them and said, hey, strategic partnership makes sense. Let's figure out how to partner together. We kept it really simple, kind of, you know, baby steps. And finally one day they said, oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Let's dig in. Well, unbeknownst to us, that was because they had already made the decision they were going to buy us. And then they wanted to just kind of, you know, vet the process and go through that in slow roll. But, you know, really 6 months, a year into that, that was during the, really, really core time of COVID when we were
trying. Those were the dark days of COVID.
Really, really dark days.
Getting a transaction completed during the isolation days of COVID was, we could do a whole podcast probably just on that.
We could. Though I'm not sure my heart can handle that again. Might go into cardiac arrest. But with that said, yeah. So they had identified us, but we definitely were the ones who kept driving and pushed the relationship. It ended up being very cool strategic relationship for about 6 months until they got really serious about the conversation and kind of brought us in. So it was about a year cradle to grave from initial agreement that we started really truly partnering with them and when they acquired us.
Yeah, that happens so often, and I think, you know, managing that well to get to an outcome or a great partnership is such a critical skill. And I know we weren't staffed up. We didn't have a partnership department or, you know, all that. So that was a lot of you and the executive team driving that. Right. So kudos to you for that.
Thank you.
Well, that's great, John. There's a lot of great lessons here. You know, congratulations on that successful journey. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah. So I've had the opportunity to raise what's called a search fund. It's kind of a unique vehicle. I call it a little bit the middle ground between VC and PE. So if you haven't looked at the search fund, it's fascinating. Don't everybody go and search until I've acquired my company. But I have some incredible investors, including Next Coast, who supported us with Chargeback, who have invested in me to go out and acquire a business that I intend to personally operate. So very different than private equity in I will actually step in day to day, interact, be part of the organization. So organization who's ready to grow to the next step that has really kind of hit that infancy of a few million in ARR and now wants to go on, but maybe is in a little bit smaller TAM or, you know, a market where growth has been a little bit more controlled, we'll say. Has a little bit different, more difficult buying cycle and or succession planning, right? Great historic organizations that don't necessarily have succession in services and software and things across the board like that are really the key targets. And so I'm excited. I'm really lucky. I have some incredible founders and business owners who have entrusted me to kind of go through the process and to court the opportunity to acquire them. Unfortunately, to date, I don't have that that transaction completed, but I have some.
Well, that's why it's called the search process, right?
It is. But an incredible process.
For the listener, like, how long is a typical search process?
Yeah, so Stanford would say that it's 18 months on average to acquire a business in the search process. But typically searchers go into it understanding that there's a pretty regular 24-month search cycle. You want to, of course, acquire as quickly as you can in that process and get to operating. Most of the folks.
But you want to find the right company, though, too. You got to balance those two things.
Absolutely.
Right?
And it's truly a balance. It's a struggle every day to recognize, you know, no company is perfect. So you have to recognize out of your criteria, let's say it's 10 or 12 items that are in your criteria, one or two of those are going to be questionable at best when you dig into the org. Very few people get to check the box on every one of their
criteria. Everything. Yeah. If it was, it would be already purchased, right? Yeah. Or not for sale. Yeah.
Or too expensive.
Yeah, that's right. Well, John, I wish you the best of luck in that. And when you are on that journey, we'll have you back on to share your lessons from the next journey. And we hope to see you at our Growth Elevated Summit this winter.
Excited for it. Julian, thanks so much for what you're building here and the lives and the CEO's lives that you're impacting. As you know, can be a lonely world. So your efforts to make it less so are incredible. So kudos to you.
Hey, we're enjoying it. Thanks, John. Have a great day today.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.